Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to New Book in Chinese Studies. My name is Yizhen from University of Pennsylvania, one of your channel hosts at the New Book Networks. Today, we are delighted to have Professor Brian DeMar from Tulane University with us on air to discuss his new monograph titled Tiger, Tyrant, Bandit, Businessman, Echoes of Counter-Revolution from New China, which is just published by Stanford University Press, August 2022. So using rare grassroots archives, the book dives deep into four true criminal cases during the political campaign to suppress counter-revolutionaries of the People's Republic of China during its early years from 1949 to 1953. The first case file recounted a story of a Confucius scholar who found himself aligned with bandits and the secret society members. The second case file was on an assassination of a communist cadre by a farmer who was condemned as a landlord and as an evil tyrant by the party. The third case file was about how the two runaway landlords avoided persecution of the party state by exploiting relative and religious networks in local community. And the fourth case file was on a hapless merchant who accused of a crime he did not commit. Read collectively, the book shows how the newly established party state brought its power to village society. And more importantly, the book persuasively demonstrates that the rural revolution could only be understood within its specific local context. In addition, the book also does a model work in showing the historian's craft of critically reading, analyzing, and using archive documents. So, Professor DeMar, congratulations on your new publication.
Thank you, Yi. I'm thrilled to be here talking about the book with a fellow specialist on rural China. I couldn't ask for a better host.
Thank you. I'm really looking forward to our interview today. So my first question is a classical one at New Book Networks. That is, what brought you to this specific book project?
Well, I'm really happy to talk about this because this book is in many ways the culmination of my entire career as a historian of China, which is to say I started visiting China in the late 90s. I lived there for 5 years in the early 2000s. And then I visited China as often as I could until the world turned upside down a few years ago. And the entire time I was in China, I was hunting for documents. I'm lucky enough to have lived in China during what historians sometimes call the golden age of archival research. And I'll start out by saying it wasn't so golden. It was still a difficult time to do research and archival work. So, you know, over the years, all I did really was look for documents, really, you know, anything I could find. So I spent a lot of time in the National Library. I visited all sorts of archives at the provincial level, the city level, and the county level. I utilized private markets, either visiting old bookstores or more importantly, buying things online. And I also did field work where, you know, I went to the countryside to meet with villagers, to talk about rural revolution. And I also did a lot of kind of informal field work where I just went, traveling. And I always tell my students that they need to, as soon as they can, go to China, get on a train, go traveling. There's really nothing like the thrill of traveling around the Chinese countryside and seeing all the wonderful diversity. And I'll note here that my travels did take me to northern Jiangxi, which is right next to Poyang County, is where we went visiting. But as for what brought me to this specific project, it was these sources. So all of those years and years of hunting for sources finally paid off for me when I was able to have this very small but very, very rich collection of archival sources. And so in that sense, the sources dictated the topic. I didn't seek out this book. This book found me.
Yeah, your field work sounds just very productive. And actually, your answer has already touched upon the next question I will ask. So I know, like we all know, the usage of archive documents is always a key for historical studies. And this book is no exception, as you discussed. The primary documents your book relied on are from the archival collection titled Materials on Poyang County, Northern Poyang Spies, Bandits, and the Secret Society Activity. In Chinese, it's Poyang Xian Po Bei Te Wu Tu Fei Hui Men Huo Dong Cai Liao. So, yeah, as you mentioned, could you please talk about how rare and valuable these documents are?
Yeah, so let me first say that archival sources are not the only kind of valuable sources, and that in my work, I utilize a whole range of sources, including published materials like land reform novels or operas. But that said, in terms of archival documents, these are as rare and as valuable as they get. They were created by the county level Public Security Bureau. So, you know, the county for thousands of years, the lowest level of government administration. So these are as close to the people, close to the grassroots, if we want to use that word, as you can get. I just want to note from the start that they were created by essentially the cops, police officers, and security officers. So they're very problematic in that regard. And I always need to keep that in the forefront of my mind when I'm working with them. They were created by the Public Security Bureau to further aid their control over local society, which in Poyang meant villages. Exactly who archived them is unclear. It's not the case that the archivists were self-conscious about who they were and what they were doing and why they were doing it, which is another level of complexity here, because we have an archive without a clear and an identifiable archivist. But you can find some clues as to when they were archived and for what reason, in terms of it'll state it was archived by a certain working group that only existed for a few years. So you can sometimes get a sense of when they were archived. I should further note that it's very lucky that this archive even existed in the first place. Not all rural public security bureaus kept their archives. Many just trashed their files after the trials were concluded. They just didn't see the point in holding on to them. So this is a point that Michael Schoenhals makes in his book, Spying for the People, which was very influential for me. But as he notes that the central Public Security Bureau leaders had to tell counties to keep these archives. So that's just one of many, many happy accidents along the way that allowed the publication of this book.
I'm happy for you, and I'm happy to see the final production of this long-term archive journey is just a productive and a very fantastic book. So yeah, as you said, like you also wrote at the very beginning of the book that the documents this project relied on, they include many uncommon voices of rural folk and those kind of revolutionaries, as you said, the grassroots voices. But at the same time, as you just discussed, and also you discussed it many times throughout the book, that these documents are far from perfect or complete. They are recorded by the cops, right? So they include many filtered information. Of course, we historians always deal with the filtered information, but I'm sure those who have already read your books will agree with me that the way you deal with the primary sources is just impressive and marvelous. But could you please discuss, like, you know, is there any specific strategy or methodology you do with these documents with our audience who do not read your book yet?
The documents are just amazing. Let me start by noting that I'm not the only person who has worked with documents such as these. There's a group of scholars that I've identified in my book as belonging to the new field of Poyang studies. And I was able to reach out to them and talk to them about working with these sources. And it's funny because when you talk about the sources, they all get this certain look on their face of just, you can see all the frustrations and trouble that these sources have given them. And I would say there's two essential problems with the sources. The first is the material conditions of the sources. So the pages are torn, their characters are very hard to read. And I want to make very clear is that I did have some help when I worked with these sources because they're all handwritten. And I like to think that my Chinese is pretty good, but reading this handwritten scribble from semi-literate villagers from the 1950s is very, very difficult. So what I did is I relied on a team of undergraduate research assistants who transcribed the materials into typed Chinese, which was much easier for me to work with. So I want to give a special shout out to my three research assistants, all very atypical Tulane students in that none of them were finance majors. They were all students in the School of Liberal Arts, or there was one in the School of Public Health. So they really helped me. But the difficulty of just understanding the characters on the page cannot be overstated. There was this one character that kept on popping up in one of the documents that my student and I were having a lot of difficulty with. And one day she came and she told me that she had figured it out. And I asked her how she had done that. And she had used WeChat to send the character to her grandmother in Shanghai, who properly identified what that character was. So in terms of working with the documents, I sometimes will say this was truly a family affair because the sources, the quality, and a lot of times the characters would be miswritten, which was a problem. So that's the first problem, and the second is that what I like to say is that the files are full of voices, but who can you trust? So some of the men in the book were charged with serious crimes such as murder, and they all claim that they're innocent. Everyone who talks to the cops is innocent in their view. And then there are the Public Security Bureau security officers, and they are trained to with a certain worldview where they assume that the countryside in Poyang is just like the countryside everywhere else before the communists come to power, which is to say it's a bastion of feudal power full of reactionary landlords and evil tyrants. So that filters how they see things. And they are the ones who entered, confessions and statements into the record. So it's very difficult. And what I'll say is that, how to deal with all these problems. Well, on a certain level, they can't be solved. So there's a certain level of imperfection baked into the book. You just can't solve all of these problems. But some things could be solved through what I akin to detective work. And I spent a lot of time just looking for anything I could find about these villages. So I did a lot of time, for example, hunting for clues in local gazetteers. And one example I have is that in the first case file, there's a location called Hengyong that's very essential to the story, but I just could not find it on any map anywhere. And it wasn't until I was digging through a local gazetteer that I realized that back in the 1950s, the entire township had been buried underneath a water reservoir. And so it just ceased to exist. And, you know, this is one of many aha moments in the book. So the other one is that I like to talk about is that in the third case file, what I call the case of the Bodhisattva Society, at the heart of that criminal investigation, there was a reference to a 1930 murder when a local communist organizer had been murdered. And what I eventually realized was that the security officers had entered his name incorrectly into the record. And so I had difficulty figuring out who he was. It was very confusing to me why he didn't show up in the list of martyrs in the official Poyang County County Gazetteer. And I eventually realized that they had gotten it wrong, and I was able to realize that they were talking about someone else who was in the Poyang County Gazetteer. And the Gazetteer had mentioned where he had been basically sold out. Some local elites had turned him over to the Kuomintang, the nationalists at that time. And so, you know, I entered the name of the village where he had been captured into Google Maps, actually. And when you hit enter, you know, Google Maps does that thing where it zooms into the location. And it zoomed into this location in Poyang County, exactly where the guy I was looking for should have been. So this is another one of these great aha detective moments, like, yes, this is it. These are two examples of mysteries from the problems in their archival files that I was able to solve. But for the most part, you know, these mysteries, these textual problems cannot be solved. So in the end, what I did is I constructed the narrative for each case file as best as I could. And at the end of each case file, I pause and I discuss with my readers all the textual issues that vexed me. And so that's why I think that this makes this book really suitable for people who care about the practice of history or for students. So, you know, one of the things that I think about a lot is that to me, I think our field of history is in a crisis. And I think part of that is that, you know, there's a misunderstanding of what history is. You know, some people think it's memorizing dates. That's not it. And, you know, some people think it's kind of these popular histories where, for me, all too often, the narrative kind of overshadows the sources. So what I wanted to do was to really dig in to the documents, to the sources, and get everything I could get out of them and nothing more. So I didn't embellish anything. I didn't add anything. I didn't invent anything. And I really do hope that readers will agree with me that the closer to truth that history gets, the better and more readable it becomes.
Yeah, thank you. First of all, thank you so much for sharing with us the many aha moments during the research. And also, I, as a reader of your book, I really love, at the each chapter, at the end of the each chapter, you discussed the documents with your readers. That is really helpful. It's like, you know, I do not only learn something from what had been recorded in primary documents, but also I learn from the limitations and the silence of the archive documents you used in your book. So following the several pages of a few words before we begin and a timeline of events, you have one chapter discussing the setting of your research, Poyang County. All of the four criminal cases in your book occurred in this county, Poyang County, which is located in the northeastern part of the Jiangxi province. And as you described in your book, this place is just a modest corner of rural China. So why did you take this small place as your research site for the study of the rural revolution in the PRC? Is it a typical rural county in China, or it is not?
It's very typical. And that's not just me who says that. I'm going to refer to the godfather of Poyang studies, Mo Bogao, who is from Poyang, was born to a poor peasant family, and because of the Cultural Revolution, was given an opportunity to go to university, and he now is a professor of Chinese studies in Australia. And he's written two books about Po Yang that were incredibly helpful to me. And I also was able to chat with him about his home county. And as he makes clear in his book, his books, Po Yang is utterly typical. And that's why I'm very happy that it became the focus of this study. You know, I often think about Zhangzhuang, which is a village in Shanxi that we know much better as Longbow, which was the site of William Hinton's book about land reform called Fanshen. And Fanshen was a very atypical place. They had a large Catholic community. They were kind of semi-occupied by Japan during the war. Whereas Po Yang is just another county in China. It's very rural. It has very little in the way of industry. I was recently workshopping the book with the last group of students, and I had a student from China, from the PRC, who asked this same question because he had never even heard of Po Yang. No, he hadn't. So it really flies under the radar. But that's what it's very typical, you know. So that's one of the reasons why I'm very happy that I ended up on studying this place. And I think that, you know, reading the documents and reading about Po Yang, it really brings home to me the power of the local in China, because the world of Po Yang is so insular. And when the communists come, you know, there is this kind of great struggle between the outside forces of the state and locals who are trying to push back. And it really kind of underlines just how important it was for local identity, for your village, your family, all of those things. And I'll just note here, I really enjoyed learning about Po Yang over the course of writing this book. I delved very deep into Po Yang history. I was, you know, reading about what was happening during, you know, the Qin and Han dynasties there. So it's a place with a great history, but you know, for most people, it's just another county in China.
Yeah, Professor Damar, so what do you just discussed, it just occurred to me, like, you know, how limited we know about the rural vast place in China, right? So even though we have already know a lot about the recent past of the PRC, but what we know about the rural China is just limited. I found that it is really helpful to introduce this county and its rich history before diving into the four cases in your book. And at the same time, I noticed that I think, if I'm wrong, please correct me, I think you intentionally avoided to mention any secondary scholarship in the main text in this setting part. Instead, at the end of the book, you provided a further reading for readers, including Gao Mobo's, his classic two books, two volumes on the Po Yang County. You also include a great discussion of secondary scholarship in your extensive footnotes. So why didn't you include a regular literature review part in the introduction chapter in this book? I mean, it is quite a standard practice, right, to include a section on literature review in the introduction chapter. Why you didn't?
Well, I'm glad you pointed it out, because this book is atypical. So, you know, we can go back to the what you mentioned. So it starts with a few words before we begin, instead of a standard preface. And it's very self-conscious. I made a lot of choices when I wrote this book. So I knew, and it all comes down to the audience of the book, which is not for specialists. Obviously specialists will read this book, and I hope that they enjoy it, and I hope they get a lot out of the book. But I really wrote this book for our students. So, you know, instead of calling it a preface or a prologue, I call it a few words before we begin, to signal to readers, including student readers that they're part of this journey. And this is written for them. And I hope that they're going to join me as the author in this exploration. And for the setting, you know, I didn't use the word introduction, first of all, because most students will skip the introduction, but also because I wanted to emphasize a sense of place and draw readers in and give them a lay of the land and let them understand, you know, where is the lake? Where are the mountains? Where do the bandits hide out? What use are bamboo? Like, how do the locals use bamboo? How do they use timber? All of those things. And so if I can give readers a sense of place, that's kind of what I was aiming for. And that's why there's not a standard literature review within the text. Now, at the end of the book, there is a list of suggested readings for each chapter or case file, where I discuss some of the books that were important to me and some of the books that I hope that my readers will seek out. As I note, this is just one book in a very rich and growing field, and I want them to seek that out. So I didn't put the lit review in the book because I had a clear sense of the audience. And the audience of this book, the most important audience, are our students who don't know who Mobile Gao is. They barely know who I am, right? And I'm the one writing the book that they're reading. So I tried to keep everything as quickly flowing as possible. And specifically about the setting is that I wanted to get to the case files as quickly as possible. So this book has been workshopped with multiple classes of undergraduates. And the thing that I learned was that just because something is interesting to me does not mean that it's going to be interesting to my students. They wanted to get to the case files. So that's what I endeavored to do. And I will note here that I cut out a lot of prose that was very precious to my heart. Some of it is found in the footnotes, but some of it is lost to history.
I see. Yeah, I believe students will love this book. It's just included as fantastic tales and all of the dramas, and also they will get the historical insights. So the title of your book is Tiger, Tyrant, Bandit, Businessman. By the way, I really love the cover design of your book, which are the protagonists of this book. I think you these four labels instead of, using a uniform counter-revolutionaries to indicate the various constantly changing identities and the labels of these people in Poyang County. So could you talk more about your protagonists, like, you know, who they are, who exactly they are, and why did they resist the new order of the Communist Republic, and how did they become the counter-revolutionaries?
Well, thank you for asking this question. I'll note that the title came out of working on the documents. In that, I just couldn't believe what I was finding. I remember one day I was sitting in my office with one of my research assistants, and we were talking about the characters that were emerging from the documents. And, you know, when we thought about Big Tiger and these tyrants and the bandits and the businessmen, it just all came together. And I love the title in particular because it puts the spotlights on those individuals. You know, rural Chinese as a group, there's no group that's larger and less heard of in the historical record. So what I wanted to do was highlight these individuals, and you see that in the case files. And I'll just go over the case files just really quickly for your listeners. And I'm not going to provide any spoilers here. I really hope that everyone listening to this goes out, seeks out the book, reads these stories, hears these voices, because they're all amazing. So case file one, that's the bandit case. And in this one, we have the arrival of the People's Liberation Army, and the locals in Poyang are mostly fearful. So one of the things I point out is even farmers who should have looked forward to the arrival of the communist a communist. They didn't know what to expect. The villages were very insular, and they all had to look out for themselves. So you have all sorts of self-defense organizations, including secret societies, most importantly, the Big Swords. And the Big Swords, for a few years, had been fighting off local bandits. Then the People's Liberation Army comes and says secret society members are also counter-revolutionaries. So they actually end up teaming up with their former enemies, the bandits. And the result is that there's a large-scale, three-pronged attack on a communist government outpost that has a very deadly result. In Case File 2, this is our Tiger case file. It refers to Big Tiger, which is the nickname of a farmer who had basically two things going for him. One was his big size. He was like a tough hooligan, and also his family. He was connected to the local family that kind of ran things in his corner of the mountains. He becomes a tax collector and abusing his power. He has an affair that's very scandalous. That's a big part of this case file. And then a communist cadre comes to his village to requisition grain. And as a result, some local elites conspire to have Big Tiger and some other tough guys go and murder this cadre. And the thing that I really love about this case is that it's really clear to everyone involved that Big Tiger was a murderer. But it took years for even though the communists were technically in power, it took years for them to arrest him, which is just really, it sheds a lot of light on kind of the way that justice works during this moment of regime change. Case File 3, that's the case of the Bodhisattva Society. And this is they're all fascinating, but this is another great one. So here we have two landlords that are charged as evil tyrants. So we go back to the title, this is our tyrant. They escape from prison, which is in itself an amazing, oh my God, what am I finding in the documents? You never thought that, you'd have these evil tyrants escape from jail. And then while they're hiding out in the countryside, there's another landlord who had been on the run. He had left his village during land reform, but he had no place to go. So he turns himself in to the Public Security Bureau. He says, hey, I have a lead on those other two evil tyrants. And the PSB has him go undercover as basically a secret agent to find these undercover or these hidden on the run evil tyrants. And let me say again, wow, I was really surprised when that happened. And also in this case file, there's a rumor about undead landlords roaming the hills. This one was just, it was a very fun one to work on and write. The final case file is our businessman. That's Merchant Ja. He's a struggling businessman who's trying to run his oil press when the communists come to town, and that brings him into conflict with local cadres. The end result, he is charged as a counter-revolutionary for a whole litany of crimes, even spying for a hated army. And I think his case more than any other shows how easy it was to become a counter-revolutionary. So, in terms of the question, how do these people become counter-revolutionary? There's all sorts of different ways it happens. But the unifying theme is that the power of the accusation of counter-revolution during this period.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing with us. So I find, as you discussed, under the label counter-revolutionary, there were bandits who wanted to get military equipment from the People's Liberation Army and those who really have the ties with the nationalists. But also there were ordinary rural folk who resisted like the grain requisition policy of the Chinese Communist Party and those whose power or benefits were threatened by the new order established by the Chinese Communist Party. So like as you wrote in your book, I quote from you, so the line between the farmer and outlaw, between the outlaw and the nationalist, as you wrote, was actually very thin and permeable. And you said, during difficult times, some struggling villagers used the force to take whatever they could from their neighbors. And when an economic crisis passed, bandits expected to return to farming. I mean, when I read this, first it came to my mind is, oh yes, this is just a strategy of ordinary rural folk used to survive, right? But at the same time, it just occurred to me that how this straightforward fact at the grassroots level could be ignored, right? When we focus on the grand top-down narratives. And also, like in the case files 2, 3, 4, were took place in a branch of the People's Tribunal instead of a traditional People's Court. So according to your research, at the early days of the New Republic, there was a dual-track legal system, which included the traditional People's Courts and the newly established Tribunal Courts. Could you elaborate more on this dual-track legal system? Why was it established at the early days of the PRC, and how did it work at the grassroots level?
So here I'm going to first note that this is something that's been pretty well explored by other of my colleagues in the new and growing field of Poyang studies. But just to give a quick overview of their work and my work, you already have a regular court system in Poyang that becomes the People's Court. But it's just not large enough to deal with all of the criminals that are created by the revolutionary campaigns. So the People's Tribunal system is set up very quickly, and it's attached, of course, to the new and growing administration. And its primary purpose is to deal with rural criminals that are, well, I'll call them counter-revolutionaries here, but it could be also anyone who pushed back against land reform or grain requisition. So in the sense that they are defying the new regime, that makes them counter-revolutionaries. It's not that they are actively pushing for the return of the nationalists. So the People's Tribunals were a way to kind of quickly deal with the thousands of criminals that were created during this very dramatic moment of regime change. It's short-lived, but you know, it really is a key part of the arrival of communist power in the countryside.
Mm. I think this dual-track legal system is part of a new invention of the Chinese Communist Party. And the subtitle of your book is Echoes of Counter-Revolution from New China. You mentioned in your book that you intentionally used New China instead of People's Republic of China. So I mean, like, we all know that existing scholarship has already uncovered many connections between Chinese communist ruler and its predecessors. Your book also spares great spaces in discussing the similar ruling strategies used by Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese Nationalist Party. So could you please elaborate on the new part of the state? What made the New Republic different from its predecessors?
Well, in essence, the new Chinese state, New China or the PRC, were able to do the things that earlier regimes had longed to do, which is to bring the power of the state down to the grassroots. So, you know, when we go back to imperial times, you have, you know, one magistrate in Poyang County with this huge population trying to manage things with clerks and runners. The Republic of China, the nationalists, they get closer, they set up district governments, which aren't very effective. They set up a actually relatively successful Baojia system that brings the state a little bit closer, although it's very informal. So people in the Baojia system are not paid. There's a lot of corruption. We see that in case file 2 with Big Tiger, but they are able to collect taxes and conscript soldiers. But That's about it. Now, I will note, those are two very, very important things. But what's new here is how the power of the state comes right down to your village. And I think we actually really see that with Big Tiger, because Big Tiger committed murder, but all of his actions after he committed murder indicate that he didn't really think that he would have to pay for his crimes. He continued to live in his mountain community. He did not try to flee. He did not go on the run. And he really acted as if, you know, that he believed that the communists were like the nationalists, right? What are they going to do? He's up in the mountains, far from state power, surrounded by his powerful family. He's also a big tough guy himself. But what he learned and what readers will learn is that this is a different kind of state. It's one that is able to bring the power of the state right down to the grassroots. They do it with a series of political campaigns. So, you know, we talk about land reform. We talked about campaigns against evil tyrants, the anti-counter-revolutionary campaign, and this really systematic legal system, which is really quite new. So I think for the villagers of Poyang, who were long accustomed to a distant state that when it arrived, it was mediated by local power holders, they were not prepared for new China.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Professor Damar, so I have to say you write very fast. I mean, if my memory is correct, your first monograph, which is Mao's Cultural Army, right, was published in 2015. And your second book, the Land Reform, was just published in 2019. Many audiences of New Book Networks, including myself, are PhD students, early career scholars. So is there any tips you want to share with us, like how to be such a productive scholar or writer?
I'm a little awkward when I answer this question. I'm going to push back a little bit that there were 8 years between my PhD and Mao's Cultural Army. So in terms of, you know, my early career productivity, it was not that productive. To any early career researchers, my first message is that you should not look at my recent productivity and think that this is normal or even possible. When I first finished graduate school, I spent the vast majority of my time applying for jobs and learning how to teach. So to everyone out there, my first message is to attend to your mental and physical health. Academia is unkind and the academy will never love you back. But it is true that I have picked up the pace, I guess, in the last few years. And part of that, let me point out, it's due to the fact that I have tenure. I have support. I can get research assistance. I have a lot of students who enjoy working on history with me, and so that's very helpful. But I do want to try to offer some piece of advice. So I think that what it comes down to is I'll focus on the issues of scope and audience. So I'll talk about scope first. And one of academia's many problems is the disease of more. So when you send out for something for review, what the reviewer always says is, you know, why don't you add this? And when you go for tenure, that's the same thing. It's like, why don't you write another article or two? So in terms of writing, you know, a first monograph, I just want to say, you know, you need to, from the start, accept that you're not writing a total history, right? It's impossible to figure out, you know, how to put everything on the page. So you have to figure out, you know, what's important and define the scope of what you're going to do. And so I think this is something that you see in all of my books. If you look back at Mao's Cultural Army, you know, I'm looking at the role of drama troops in the revolution, but then I only discuss a tiny fractions of the thousands of drama troops that were in the countryside, right? So I don't talk about everything. I chose my spots and said, you know, I'm going to talk about, you know, these drama troops for this period and then these ones for this period. For land reform, defining the scope of the project was even more important, because if I was to write a book about land reform that covered everything, I would still be writing it. I would probably never finish it. That's land reform. It's such a huge topic. And so, you know, what I did there is I said, well, you know, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the narrative of land reform. I'm going to use that as the framework. And I'm not going to worry about covering everything, you know. And of course, when the book came out, a lot of the reviewers pointed out, well, it's missing this, it's missing that, it's missing that. And I would say, of course it is, because otherwise this book wouldn't exist. And, you know, for this one, I really had no choice. These were the four sources I had. I only had four case files. And even here, you know, I did have to push back against the idea that I had to add more and more. Because as I mentioned earlier, my readers, in fact, wanted less. Sometimes they were overwhelmed by all of the detail I was giving them, especially when I was talking about Poyang's vast history. And so I needed to really get to the point, which kind of brings me to the second, I guess, thing I'll talk about, which is your audience, and that you got to continually ask yourself, who are you writing for? You know, so for early career scholars, I just point out one of your most important audience is your editor, right? You know, it's their job is on the line. They got to pick books that make sense and that will sell at least a few copies. So, you know, there's a book called, I think, Thinking Like Your Editor. It's not exactly aimed at authors such as ourselves who are writing in serious academic scholarship. It's a bit more for popular nonfiction. But, you know, I found some of those lessons useful. And you have to remember that, you know, these editors, when they read your proposal, they're asking themselves, you know, who is going to read this book? They're concerned about audience. So, you know, besides thinking, you know, what's the editor, you know, how am I going to convince my editor to accept this project? You have to say, who do you really think is going to be reading your book? And so for a first book author, I think that means identifying two or three seminars where your book would fit, and then keeping those seminar students in mind as you write the book. And you do need to think about, are these graduate students or are these graduate students and undergraduates? Because undergraduate readers are different than graduate readers, right? So graduate readers, they approach the book as professional historians, whereas undergraduate readers are, you know, they're in your class. So if you want to actually have undergraduates read your book, you need to think strategically about how you write it. And I wish I could have better advice than that, but I'll say that. And I'll also just circle back to the long period of time that it took me in between my PhD and my first book. It's a very struggling, a very challenging period. And I send positive vibes to all PhD students and early career scholars.
Thank you. I mean, the tips and suggestions you gave is just super helpful. At the end of your book, you talk a little bit about, like, you know, this book was written during the pandemic, right? Could you share with us, like, and I'm myself very curious about, like, you were writing experience during the pandemic, because I basically wrote my dissertation during the whole pandemic, which is challenging, I would say. So is there any, like, interesting episodes you want to share with our audience?
Well, the first thing I'll say is to everyone, however you survived the pandemic, that was the good way to do it. Okay. So I don't want to suggest that during pandemics, you should be productive, because sometimes it's impossible to be productive. But what happened with me is that when my son's school went virtual, I was able to add hours to my day, as I didn't have to worry about driving him around. And what I would say is this, is that it was a very challenging time for me, as it was for everyone, right? I'm not special in that regard, but it was very challenging. So what I did is I tended to throw myself into Poyang. It was my way of coping, was that for a few hours a day, more than a few, I would leave 2020 and I would go back to 1950 and I would immerse myself in the documents and I'd immerse myself in the files. And that there was some comfort in that. And also what I would say is that I reached out to everyone I could think of who was either working, you know, a member of the Poyang Studies Group or people who had interest in China, in rural China and the revolution. And I reached out to them and set up Zoom calls, and that was really helpful for the project, but for also for my sanity. But again, there's no good way to spend a pandemic. But for me, at least at the end of the day, I have this book, and I'm very thankful for it. Not just because you know, it's good for me and my ego to have a book, but because I am honestly very happy and proud that I was able to find these voices in the archive and share them with readers. It's something that I consider kind of the one of the very highest of highlights of my career.
Thank you, Professor. So let's talk about what is your next project?
Well, okay, this is a tough question. It's somewhat complicated by the fact that to congratulate me on becoming full professor, my colleagues in the Tulane History Department have decided that I am now going to be chair of the department, which means that instead of writing scholarship for the next 3 years, I'll mostly be writing emails that start, "Dear colleagues, please excuse this." You know, so
sorry.
Yeah, I want to be really careful and thoughtful about what I do next. I'm at that stage where I'm very much aware. I only have so many summers left in my life. I want to use them wisely. This is somewhat complicated. I'm not sure if you know this. Some of your listeners might know this, but 6 months ago, I was leaving a dinner that we had for a visiting scholar, and I was walking back to my car, and I was run over crossing the street and nearly died. I was very lucky. The angle that the car hit me, the size of the car, and of course my natural historian cat-like reflexes allowed me to walk away. But it really was a traumatic event, and so I'm forcing myself to take a beat and to think about what I want to do next. That said, there's a couple of projects that I'm working on. I'll talk about one of them because it relates to the biggest problem I found in the sources, which are the lack of female voices. Readers will all pick up on the fact that there's only one woman who's actually named in the case file. So I really am sensitive to the fact that I'm someone who has been trained in the history of women in China. I teach on this topic, and I wrote this book with almost no women in it. So I do want to I have some archival leads. I want to go and investigate that. But I have some other projects that I'm looking at that have nothing to do with rural China, nothing to do with the Chinese Revolution. I do have some thoughts, and I hope that I'm able to live to see them come to fruition, because I think that they would surprise my colleagues and hopefully delight some of my readers.
I'm really looking forward to reading your other research on either gender studies and topics outside of the revolution in China. So, at the end of the interview, I want to say thank you again for joining us to discuss your fantastic new book today. I also want to say thank you for our audience who have the patience to hear through this interview. The interview today actually, like both Professor Damar and I, did not include too many details of the four tremendous tales included in the new book. We don't want to be the spoiler. And so I strongly encourage everyone who has an interest in Chinese history or want to get a marvelous introduction to the historian's craft to get your own copy. I promise you will get both the fantastic tales as well as historic insights. Okay, goodbye, everyone.